You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Lisa, it's time for the International Desk.
Yes.
So what's at the International Desk today?
We're finally going to cover Sudan, which is something that we've been kind of willing to do for a little while. I know you wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Kind of at the beginning and back in, I think, maybe December or...
Yeah, right when the protests initially first kicked off, and then I said that we were going to discuss it last week, but however I didn't feel comfortable quite addressing it fully, so now is the time.
Yes. Also, usually the international agenda is filled with lots of things that are happening, and I thought this week was actually slightly more quiet for some reason, which doesn't mean that non-important things have happened. I just thought that would be a good opportunity to discuss
Sudan. I think it's definitely, and it's an ongoing one that continues to evolve. A lot has happened since last week even. But I'm sure we'll find out soon. We'd love to hear from you as well on your views on what's happening in Sudan, as well as on any of the pieces you've already heard in BFM on The Wire today. You've, of course, heard a discussion about active transport and about the platforming of Pacific and Oceania Voices. But now, if you've got any views on the international realm, we'd love to hear from you. Call us or text us. But now, if you want to find out more before giving us
your opinion,
here we go.
So just for those of you who might not know where Sudan is, what Sudan is, it's an African nation. It is located northeast of the African continent, and it's got an interesting plurality of identities. It is both Arabic and African, and those two identities have been sometimes in the past quite hard to reconcile, and that led to people having sometimes issues with one another. And so the protests that the country has been experiencing for a few months now actually don't have much to do with ethnic issues. It all started in the eastern part of the country, northeastern part of the country. That was back in December 2018. And it's just groups of civilian people that decided to take to the streets because they were protesting the cost of life in the country. So a few things have happened recently in Sudan's past that have made the country face a pretty bad economic crisis. First of all, the United States has had sanctions and embargo against Sudan for 20 years. That was from 1997 to 2017. It all started because the United States thought that the Sudanese government was supporting terrorist groups, so decided to impose economic sanctions, which have been really harmful to the country. And so these sanctions were lifted in 2017, but that hasn't really... I don't know if it's because we're lacking kind of time between the end of the sanctions or because just... I don't know, but economically...
There hasn't been much like rebound time from the sanctions yet. 2017 was still... I mean, it's 2 years ago, but 2 years of economic recovery isn't a lot of time. So probably hence why that shows in numbers. Again, like inflation as well. There's an intriguing kind of visual graph or data visualizer kind of thing, data visualizer thing, that has kind of the countries mapped based on inflation, and Sudan for a huge period when it was back, when it was united, was streaking ahead, ages ahead of any country. However, it's kind of comical the amount and the speed it took for Venezuela to overtake it now. But I guess you can see a kind of comparative thing of what sanctions have done to a lot of countries, or at least what the kind of response to sanctions has done to countries' economic statuses, as you see by the kind of competition between Venezuela and Sudan. Anyway, back to the topic.
But it's interesting that you're mentioning that, and you also so inflation increased actually by 70%, which is huge. If we compare, we definitely I think I don't know what about something in New Zealand about like 1% or something every
nothing
nowhere near the 70%.
Exactly. That saw kind of like rising food prices get like astronomically high, obviously.
Yes.
And
So that's one of the main thing that actually started these protests, which was the price of bread, which is obviously a very common thing to eat, tripled over in a very short amount of time, which made it a very not easily accessible resource whilst still being a really essential resource. Interesting that you mentioned before it was there was the separation between the countries because for those of you who don't know, in 2011 there was a referendum on independence of South Sudan, which used to be part of the whole country of Sudan, which led to so this independence. And Sudan has always really relied on its oil resources. It's got really rich soils in terms of oil, and but with the with South Sudan gaining independence, it also removed 75% of the whole country's oil fields, which means that revenues from petrol have obviously come down quite dramatically. So those are just a few things that have made the living costs of Sudanese people much higher, and are reasons that have been put forth to explain the protests that have started occurring a few months ago. And so it all started like that, and then the protests reached the capital city of Khartoum, and it kind of turned into less of a protest about difficulties in their day-to-day life, but more into protests against the president, Omar al-Bashir, who was, I think it's fair to say, an authoritarian leader.
He came into power via coup in 1989 and has remained in power ever since.
Yeah, so 30 years of being in power. And he actually has been accused of war crimes and crimes against humanities two times, actually, well, several times by the International Criminal Court. And called for arrest in 2009, 2010. And that was for his role in Sudan's Darfur crisis. So Darfur is a region of the western side of Sudan that has a population that is not Arabic and that was facing lots of discrimination. And so, civil unrest kind of sparked in 2003 and led to 300,000 people killed and 3 million people displaced, so a really bad humanitarian crisis. So these protests kind of carried on, intensified. It's interesting to note that women make up a really big part of the protesters. It's also lots of young people, quite similar to what we saw in Algeria, actually, with lots of well-connected, like, internet savvy people kind of joining these protests. Another interesting point is that this the organization of the demonstration was actually taken on by the Sudanese Professionals Association, which is kind of like a non-politically affiliated group of workers.
It's more of a union than a political party. It kind of makes up, I believe, doctors and lawyers primarily, which is interesting.
Exactly. And I think that really helped people sort of go past the political aspect of things and have something, you know, if it had been a political opposition, it would have been harder to gather support around the cause.
I think it's this thing of it. Politics is often kind of put into like a theoretical, logical box instead of human issues, and this kind of humanizes the issues. It's the metaphor of the bread as well. Like the bread is it's something that they need but can't always get access to, and the fact that they can no longer get access to that is kind of really reiterates the issue of like why this protest has begun. And this is a protest of the people, and a rather direct protest of the people, and the organization by the unions kind of further emphasizes this. However, opposition political parties have also gotten involved to back it. However, it has, even with their support, kind of remained largely kind of civilian.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing as well. We'll touch on that a little bit later. Before, I just wanted to talk about the kind of early response from the military, which was pretty violent. A human rights group are actually talking about 50 demonstrators that would have been killed during the protest. There was tear gas, live ammunition against protests. They were actually very peaceful. And then there was kind of a change of tide with isolated soldiers deciding to stop supporting, stop, I suppose, filling their roles as part of the military and taking the civilians, the protesters' side. The president, Sir al-Bashir, decided to have a state of emergency put in place in February 2019. He tried really hard to cling on to power, actually. He dissolved the national and state governments. He changed his ministerial cabinet, and he decided to appoint new state governors. And all of these people that he appointed actually belonged to military and security forces. So as I guess, an attempt to try and sort of minimise the chances of the army going against them. Obviously, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies close. So I don't even apply to that. But yeah, that's the idea of just people that you fear might turn against you. If you give them what they want, sort of a power, they're more likely to settle for it. But that didn't work, interestingly enough, and al-Bashir was deposed on April 11th, so about 3 weeks ago, and he was replaced by a military council that was kind of decided to overlook the transition. A council led by a handful of military officials that were actually quite close to the former president. So Lieutenant General Awad ibn Auf, he was put at the helm of the council. He announced a 3-month state of emergency, 2-year transition period to prepare for civilian rule, but the protests continued, and so he had to stand down, and he was replaced by Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah Abdelrahman Burhan, who was named head of the Transitional Military Council and still is at the helm of that council. So it's currently made out of 10 members of the military. It's meant to remain in place for the next 2 years for that transitional period, and it wants a council to it wants this council to be made out of 7 military representatives and 3 civilians. And that's where it gets a bit tricky, because the civilians who gathered in a group called Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces, it's just an umbrella alliance of activists and opposition groups, they want a 4-year transition period overseen by a civilian-led council with military representation. So the idea is that basically the military wants for that council to be obviously military led, and the civilians want civilian it to be civilian led.
So is it a 7-8 split, the civilian council?
So the opposition, I guess the civilians, would like to have 8 seats for civilians, 7 seats for the military, which is quite a good ratio, except obviously they have this extra person that gives the majority, whereas the military wants like a 10 out of 15 kind of situation going on. The military has just been saying that they're not greedy, they don't want to hold on to power, but the civilian opposition is actually very, I think, sceptical of these declarations. The Professionals Association is actually has said that they really do not believe that the military intends on handing power over to civilians. And so they've called for protesters to keep putting pressure on the military council. There's been sit-ins organised in front of the Defence Ministry, and more recently calls for civil disobedience and a general strike. Because there's this idea that obviously you have to keep putting pressure and keep fighting against it to try and kind of get what you want. What's happening is that they're having negotiations at the moment to obviously discuss not only the composition of this transitional council, but also how long, what would they do, the powers, etc. And whilst this is ongoing, they're really intent on keeping the pressure on the military and carry on the protests in the streets, and more meetings are planned, and I think they're going to announce they're going to give their own, like, both sides are going to give their own version of what they want to see this transitional council be in the next few hours or days.
A couple of weeks ago as well, the civilian group, which now has an umbrella title, were meant to present their demands to the military council, however, missed that first opportunity, which I think kind of gave the military a little bit of hope in terms of, oh, well, they obviously have shown a tiny bit of incompetence now that they couldn't meet a 2-week deadline. which may have been slightly harsh of the military, but yes. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time.
No, and I mean, that also obviously shows that it's really hard for any citizen-led movement to be organized yeah. so fast. And who do you choose as your leader? So many different requests within those movements, obviously, and that it's really hard to.
I think it's this thing as well, is like they're not trying to elect, like, they've had 30 years of one leader. And from what I've read and what I've seen, I've scrolled through and roughly translated a whole heap of kind of letters to the editor from the Sydney's one of the main newspapers. And it's this interesting thing of a lot of it's, they're not looking for one leader, they're looking for a direct democracy where the civilians can actually explain what they need and what they want and operate on what they need and what they want, which they haven't been able to do for so long because of the one person leadership.
Yes, but in the eyes of everyone else, I suppose that's like completely utopic to think that you can reach that, and that it's not organized enough and it's never going to, you know, amount to anything fruitful and beneficial.
Which
to
is like why it was interesting watching for like the two, like there was 2 weeks like after al-Bashir was removed and before the military council kind of really consolidated their powers, where there were street cleaning sessions that were organized, free food for protesters, like people were repairing damages to storefronts, and people were kind of giving out free kind of healthcare and medical things. It's just this really kind of, we associate this kind of as a utopic idea, but for this kind of 2 weeks in the middle of what most people call mayhem, it's like actually perhaps this could work. Even I think that may be all we have time for in the international desk today. Is there anything you'd like to finally add?
Yes, I just wanted to draw some quick parallels because we talked about Algeria not that long ago, actually, for international desk. And the situation of both countries are actually quite similar to a certain extent. You know, they both had protests starting around rising costs of living and turned into protests against the political regime. They both had authoritarian regimes with kind of like a fake democracy going on, and people that stayed in, like presidents that had stayed in power for years and years and years. And obviously both countries have always had a strong military, so their situation's quite similar. And I think it also kind of, you can also relate that to the Arab Springs of 2011, like a lot of people have talked about Sudan and Algeria in 2019 as like, oh, it's like renewed Arab Springs, which is not necessarily not true. But if you look at the case of Egypt back in 2011, they had the civilian uprising, and then that led to a military, like the army actually controlled the transition. And then there was a coup in 2013, a couple of years after the uprising, a coup that led to a general taking power and being a new authoritarian leader. So I suppose we have to remain quite wary of like what the outcome of such great civilian protests and like uprisings can lead to.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.